Okay, welcome everybody to Personal Democracy Forum's PDF Network and our ongoing series of member-only conference calls with movers and shakers and thinkers in the industry. We're pleased to be joined on this call by Josh Koster, who's going to be talking to us about long-tail nano-targeting with Google Ads, how to find your activist voters. I want to thank our sponsors, AT&T and the Vivings Group, for their ongoing support for the PDF Network. Just want to say briefly that we're really excited about how these calls have been going. We have a full set scheduled for the next couple of months, which you can find on the PDF Network homepage at personaldemocracy.com. Just click on the yellow tab at the top. In 2 weeks, we're going to be joined by Ben Smith of Politico. The topic is how to pitch and not pitch a political blogger. And this is news. We just managed to convince Anna Marie Cox, formerly of Juan Kett and God knows how many other places, but now with the Daily Beast, I think. No, Air America, I'm sorry. Anna Marie Cox will also be joining us for the second half of that call. So we're actually going to have two very experienced political bloggers on in 2 weeks to talk with us about how you can and cannot effectively pitch to political bloggers. So please put that on your schedule for 2 weeks from this Thursday, same time as now, and let your friends know. I think it'll be a really interesting call. So again, we're joined by Josh Koster, and Josh is Managing Director at Chong Designs, LLC, which is a Washington new media advising firm that specializes in digital marketing and brand management for progressive candidates and some corporations. He's worked on presidential campaigns, Senate campaigns, House races, nonprofits, ballot initiatives, you name it. And I think this is going to be a really interesting call because he is pioneering work in a really interesting new field of a kind of directed advertising that is really built in this case around things that you can do with search and with contextual marketing that really can get down to a very granular level. So, Josh, I thought, you know, and we'll structure this call the way we do all our other calls where you and I will talk for maybe the first 15, 20 minutes and then we'll open things up for questions from others. But the why don't we start by just describing, Josh, you know, a little bit of your background, how you got into this, and what do you mean by long-tail nano-targeting?
Well, first off, can everybody hear me?
You should assume that everyone can hear you. I can hear you. I've asked everybody else to mute their phones.
Fair enough. Well, I guess starting with my history, I came into politics as a sort of traditional fundraiser, and my original, you know, couple campaign experiences were in traditional campaigning. Eventually, I moved into new media because, frankly, I got into politics very young, and new media is just the only field where ageism isn't rampant. But after getting into it, I realized just how powerful it could be, and so anyway, because of my traditional background, I came into new media kind of as a non-believer. I sort of had the mentality that if my candidates, you know, name IDs were relatively low, if I was working for a congressional that no one had ever heard of, the odds that people were going to organize around that person online were just fairly slim. So as a result, I sort of came in with the perspective that ultimately the way to win elections is to raise money and spend that money on ads to voters. And so that's sort of where my focus on online advertising came from. I've been doing it ever since.
And tell us what you mean by nano-targeting and long-tail nano-targeting.
Oh, sure. So the long-tail is actually a internet marketing theory. It's based on a book called The Long-Tail. And it's essentially the idea that on the internet, people who are internet users tend to have very niche-specific tastes. They can find whatever they want. And so if there's something they like, they learn more and more about it, they follow it. And so as a result, in order to target people based on their tastes and preferences, we sort of reach into the power of the long tail, and instead of finding people, you know, who just happen to be Democrats or happen to care about politics, we find people who happen to be Democrats, care about politics, and have a veteran living in their household, and then talk to them about veterans' issues, or any number of other issues. So the idea behind long tail nanotargeting is basically that on the internet, well, because your ad medium is a little bit less impactful than, say, a 30-second spot with music and imagery and all of that, that in order to be persuasive, you have to be hyper-relevant. And so it's about being everywhere all the time with every message you have on every issue you have.
Okay. And now, in terms of doing this with Google Ads, what does that mean? That means I'm... you know, as I'm reading my email or I'm reading a blog post, the sponsored ads that come up alongside, or do you mean actually purchasing, you know, like blog ads and on different blogs that where you think the audience is already concentrated?
All of the above. Before I really get into the specifics of how it's done, I want to just do a quick run through of the various sort of targeting options. For people on this call who might not have worked with this format before. So the first and most sort of obvious of the internet advertising formats is search advertising. Search advertising is, you know, when you buy a keyword and someone searches for that keyword, you trigger an ad. Search is unique because people tend to be looking explicitly for the type of information, that you're offering in your ad. And so it's a very high engagement rate format of advertising. You literally are trying to anticipate the questions people will have and then provide the answers there. Contextual advertising is also keyword targeted, but unlike search, the keywords that trigger the ad are the keywords on the page where the ad space is. So for instance, Gmail ad space is contextually targeted off keywords. So if I were to buy a keyword that's in your inbox, it would trigger an ad in your inbox. Or you can even target high visibility flash and banner ads or click to play ads on websites that have that kind of inventory on the Google network, based off keyword targeting. There's also behavioral targeting, which is, it's a little more controversial because, the way it works is it actually puts information on people's computers that allows the system to track them and track their behavior. So, for instance, if somebody reads a liberal blog that has behavioral targeting or that's on a behavioral targeting network, that person's computer or that they'll insert a cookie into the person's browser, and when that person goes to other sites on the network, even if they're not liberal sites, you can still identify them as somebody who goes to liberal sites and talk to them about that kind of messaging. The fourth kind of targeting is just sheer placement targeting. It's the most similar to traditional advertising in as much as you say, here's where I want to run my ads, and that's where they run.
Right. So just I think it would actually help to give specific examples. Like, for example, I think everybody understands search advertising. That's pretty, you know, you're on Google, you search for a term, you see some sponsored ads come up alongside. Contextual advertising, you gave me an example of this, so I actually went and played with it. You put the term Act Blue newsletter in an email, right? So I send myself an email saying with the words Act Blue newsletter in it. That tells you that somebody, the sponsored links that come up, one of them is for Terry McAuliffe. So what that suggests is that Terry McAuliffe, his campaign has bought contextual advertising. They're hunting for people who receive the Act Blue newsletter, right?
Yes.
Are you actually doing that campaign, by the way?
I'm not doing that campaign, but that's a keyword that I suggested buying in the article I wrote about long-tail nanotargeting. So it's refreshing to see that whoever is doing that campaign at least read the article.
Somebody's paying attention. So that's an example of contextual advertising.
Right.
Give me
another good example of that would be buying, in the last election cycle, would have been buying paid for by Obama for America.
Right.
That means anyone who's on Obama's email list was a potential ad target for you. You can do that with your competitors' email list. If you want to, for instance, if you have ads that say so-and-so is a flawed candidate, or you have an article that talks about how much they how poorly they spend their money, you can run those targeted at their own email list, and it will have some impact on the click-through rates on their emails. If every time they open that email, they also see an ad saying, you know, so-and-so wastes money.
Do you see a lot of people doing this right now?
Not enough.
Not enough. Okay. Third type of advertising, behavioral targeting. Let's unpack that a little bit more because it's complicated and I don't want people to be confused. Give me an example of how one might do that in practice.
Well, behavioral targeting in practice, you just go to a behavioral targeting network and tell them who you want to target.
Mm-hmm.
And they set it up for you. But the way behavioral targeting works is, the networks have certain sites within their network that are very specific in terms of their audience. For instance, liberal blogs or conservative blogs about social conservative issues.
Mm-hmm.
And when people go to those, it essentially just marks those people or those computers. And when anyone on those computers browse other sites on the network, the ad targeting detects the fact that they've been marked as a certain type of person,
mm-hmm.
and can aim ads at them. So, for instance, you can run ads through behavioral targeting. Say the target was liberal blog readers. Through placement targeting, you can only run the ads on the liberal blogs, meaning you only reach them when they're reading the blogs. But with behavioral targeting, you can reach those same people when they're reading other websites, which is particularly helpful if you're trying to do sort of saturation messaging towards the end. Because you don't know how much time those people are, your targets are actually spending on the placement-based sites.
Okay. And just to be clear, let's say somebody was doing that. Does the liberal blog know that readers are in effect being mined?
Yeah, they would have to opt into that ad network to have that happen.
Very interesting. Okay. And, okay, so these are examples of ways to micro-target, but then what happens? Let's say somebody actually sees your contextual ad, right, that's been placed now alongside the text, you know, that it's relevant to. Then what, you know, what are we talking about in terms of being able to convert a person? They click, and then what happens? What are we, and there are different goals here, right? Sometimes it's just to collect.
Well, to answer that question, I first have to get into one of the mistakes people have to avoid when targeting these ads.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely important when you're doing this to distinguish between campaigns whose goals are acquisition, which is to say getting email addresses or getting donors, and campaigns whose goal is persuasion, which is, you know, name ID building, awareness building, or even voter persuasion towards the end.
Okay.
And the way, not only do you target the ads differently, but sort of the whole theory about how you make those campaigns is different. With acquisition, you start by asking, what type of person am I trying to acquire? So in this case, in the Terry McAuliffe instance, he's clearly trying to acquire donors. And then you ask yourself, how do I reach donors? And, well, one thing we know about Democratic donors is that many of them have given through Act Blue at one point in the past. And so doing the paid for by, or rather the Act Blue newsletter keyword, gets you in front of people who have not only given to Democrats, but who have given to Democrats online. Or, for instance, if you're trying to acquire bodies for your field program, running ads on Facebook, which is where college kids are, is a great way to do it. With
but that's a more traditional kind. Facebook's approach to advertising is it as fine-grained as what we're describing here with Google's contextual ads?
Yes, it is. Facebook, you can, when people, all that profile information you enter about yourself, like your birthday and your gender and, you know, what gender you're interested in and all of that,
mm-hmm.
can be used for ad targeting. So it is traditional in as much as it's demographic-based targeting, but it is highly specific, much more so than, say, TV demographic targeting.
And which between Google and Facebook, which one can geo-target more precisely?
Google.
And how does Google do that? They're doing it by your IP address?
Yeah. Well, they're both doing it by your IP address, but the difference is Google allows you to actually, like, draw on a Google map where you want the ads running, Mm-hmm. So if you've got a weird little shaped congressional district, you can actually, you know, trace the district. Facebook tends to do it by major cities. So mm-hmm. you would type in, for instance, Miami.
Right.
So they're both equally good if you're trying to target down to, say, a state level. But if you're trying to target very specific congressional districts, Google is much stronger.
Sure, but if you were trying to get a state senate district that had a college in it, you could advertise on the Facebook pages of people who have identified themselves as being in that college network.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, okay.
So with acquisition, you figure out who you're trying to acquire, what your target looks like. Like, for instance, if it's a body for a field program, they're young. If it's a donor, they're someone who's potentially on an ActBlue mailing list or an Obama mailing list or reading the liberal blogs, because liberal blog readers tend to be online donors as well. And then you just test the asks, and you intentionally land them on a page that is a no-frills, you know, one-click way to complete the ask. So if it's a fundraising ad, you land them on a donation page. If it's a email acquisition ad, you land them on a splash page. If it's a volunteer ad, you land them on a volunteer page. With persuasion ads, you flip the process on its head. You start by asking, what content do I have that's persuasive? YouTube videos, news clips that even aren't on your site, you know, like what are the best 10 articles on the internet about my candidate right now? You know, what issue positions does he have? You start with the content, what you're landing people on, and then you say, who is this going to be persuasive to? And you target the ads to that audience. So, for instance, with Al Franken, he had a issue position that was specifically about giving tax breaks to people who were supporting an elderly dependent, to people who were supporting their mother-in-law. And so there was a very small audience of people who were going to care about that, but those people would probably care quite a lot. So we started by looking at that content and say, all right, well, you know, this will be very persuasive to people who are supporting parents. And then we went out and tried to figure out what types of things people who are supporting parents, elderly parents in their house, were looking for and doing. For instance, life alerts, or people who are looking for at-home nurses to come, you know, give a helping hand.
Okay. Once you've figured out those, then you are, but the content of the persuasion ad is different in terms of those 14 words or 12 words that are going to appear alongside whatever text you're advertising alongside.
Yes, absolutely. For two reasons. With acquisition advertising, the only value to the ad is the people who click through and actually get acquired. With persuasion advertising, there's value just in the impression, if you can make the message contained in the impression. So, for instance, if you have an article that's just really favorable about your candidate and you pull the best quote out of that article and put it in the ad, it doesn't necessarily matter if it has the highest click-through rate. It's more important that you take something that's really favorable and make sure it gets shown to a ton of people. So persuasion ads are sort of granular message-based ads. Often, you know, you don't even have room to fit in a call to action. Acquisition ads tend to be just explicit calls to action, because you want people who click on those ads to know what they're getting into and actually convert. So, for instance, an acquisition ad would look like, donate to the campaign. That's the call to action. There might not be any other copy besides, in this case, Terry McAuliffe for governor, donate to the campaign. An acquisition or a persuasion ad might say...
Well, I'll tell you, in his case, it says, help ensure a bright future for VA, contribute to Terry's campaign now.
Exactly. And now a persuasion ad for that campaign might say something like, endorsed by the Alexandria Tribune, or the Alexandria Tribune endorses, and it would point directly to the endorsement article. And the ad would be written in such a way that, you know, the top title would say something like, McAuliffe gets endorsed, or McAuliffe picks up another endorsement. And then the ad would contain the whole punchline, which is who endorsed and who, you know, the fact that the candidate got endorsed and who was actually doing the endorsement. Because people don't necessarily need to click through to get the warm fuzzy they need from that ad.
Right. Or as you described it in your piece, source amnesia.
Well, that's particularly useful with negative ads as well.
Yeah.
Because with text ads, you don't need a disclaimer. The disclaimer would be longer than the ad itself in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say, for instance, we were targeting our ads against just John McCain for this purpose. And we bought his name as a contextual keyword. So that means that anytime people are reading articles containing the words John McCain, our ads are eligible to appear. If you have an article that is slamming McCain and you can take the granular message out of that and put it into the ad, then what in effect you're doing is creating, you know, making it so that anyone who's reading content about McCain has somewhere on their screen a one-sentence negative. And the thing about source amnesia is it's why attack ads work. You know, people say they don't like them. The focus, a lot of times when they're focus grouped, people will say, oh, it's just another negative ad. But months later, they might not remember where they heard the fact, months later, they might not remember that the thing that they don't like about somebody came from an attack ad. They might not have a clue where they got that information from. And so if you're, you know, inserting granular attacks in text ads, people really, like, as they're scanning a news page, and one of the things they scan is, you know, John McCain is aware the internet exists, then they might not have to ever click that YouTube video. They might not ever have to, you know, even if they notice that it's in an ad, the fact is they saw it, and chances are a month from now, if they remember it, they're not going to remember where they heard it.
So, and you're, and for those ads, you're actually only paying for the click-throughs. The impressions are gravy, right?
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to start opening the call up to questions, and I see I've got one that Karen Jagoda, who's on the call, has actually messaged to me, though. Karen, you can actually, there's a way to send messages so the whole group can see them. But her question is, how do you measure the value of these persuasion ads to justify it to clients?
Well, the easiest way is to compare it to something they understand. So, for instance, most campaigns know they're going to spend a little bit of money on, and for the sake of just simplicity here, let's assume each mailer costs 75 cents to deliver, print, you know, just to get to the mailbox. Now, the average good or the average successful fundraising mailer has about a 3% open rate, or rather, I'm sorry, a 3% response rate. Now, based on internet fundraising, in order to get a 3% response rate on a email, on a fundraising solicitation, you have about a 25% open rate. So, you know, extrapolating that, you can assume that the average mailer has a 1 in 4 chance of getting read. So you have to send 4 to have, you know, every actual interaction. So in this case, each mailer or each person you, each voter interaction you get through mail costs about $3. So as long as you can get your clicks for less than $3 and you're targeting in such a way where the people who click are highly likely to be voters, which if your ads say things like read Al Franken's plan to fix the energy crisis, I mean, unlikely voters are not going to click those ads. Then as long as you're getting your clicks for less than the, you know, less than the $3 mark, you're getting a better return on investment than you are with your existing program.
Okay. You know what? We're nearing the halfway point on the call, and I've got plenty of questions, but I'm sure other people who are listening in probably have questions as well. So I'm going to open things up now. If you have a question for Josh, and we're going to just try and do this in the sort of random chaotic way that's worked up till now. Just unmute your phone and then speak up, say your name, and try and keep your question fairly short. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question kind of from the other side. It came up. I was
just wait. First, identify who you are, if you don't mind.
I'm sorry, Tom Crowell.
Okay.
I was at the Web 2.0 Summit in San Francisco in November, and it was right after the election, and there was a girl there who was very involved in the No on 8 campaign. And she had a great complaint that apparently in the last few days before the election, there are no on-8 websites, or various websites they had, were inundated with ads apparently paid for by the Yes on-8 campaign on the other side. And she was rather upset about that. And I just wondered if that has come up before, or if there's an answer to that, and maybe there was a simple answer. Maybe they should have just specified, you know, maybe there's a way that a website can say, we don't want these kinds of ads or something. I don't know. Do you understand the issue there?
Yeah, well, I've never actually dealt with having to get Google to turn off ads aimed at our sites before, though I know that Google, you can get Google to turn off ads if they're pointing at your content. Sometimes.
Because she felt it was a planned buy, you know, that
it absolutely was a planned buy. The Yes on 8 campaign ran what was probably the most sophisticated persuasion campaign besides Obama's, McCain's, and Franken's ever. They spent $500,000 in the days immediately before the election just saturating the internet with that.
So that her or No on 8 sites in particular had been singled out by the Yes on 8.
Right? It had been.
Yeah, no, I it's clearly, Tom, Josh is saying it clearly was singled out. And the question is whether Google can shut, you know, specific ads off while allowing you to continue to display Google ads.
Yeah.
And that's, Josh, I believe you're correct about that, but we will check with our friends at Google on that and get the exact answer back to folks.
Yeah, I believe it's possible as long as they're pointing at your content to have ads turned off, but I don't think it's possible with any other, you know, for any other reason unless they're breaking the law or...
Though they could have, the No on 8 site could have just decided to disable Google ads entirely on their site for that period if they wanted.
No.
They could not?
No. They would have had to have contacted Google, gotten a Google rep and said, someone is aiming ads at our content that we don't want to have permission to, and Google would make a judgment call. I've never actually done this, so I'm basing it on what I'm pretty sure how it goes, but the one time I've ever had to try to get an ad turned off, I had to contact somebody at Google, specifically send them a screenshot of the ad with the display URL and everything, and say they don't have our permission to point traffic.
As opposed to simply withdrawing from the Google Ad Network entirely?
Well, they don't have... No on 8 was never in the Google Ad Network. I mean, they may have been running their own ads, but they're not... They weren't running ads on their website, so they were not a part... They never opted into the network.
I see. So it was that the Yes on 8 people were running ads elsewhere that were pointing traffic at their site.
Yes.
That they didn't want.
Yes, and what I assume happened is No on 8.
Is that an accurate description?
Well, I thought she was suggesting that the ads were appearing on her site, but maybe.
That doesn't seem right. But it does seem quite possible to flood a site with unwanted traffic.
It could be.
In effect, why? And Josh, can you imagine why the Yes on 8 people would have been doing that?
Yes, absolutely. This is one of those issues that is particularly, you know, people have very strong feelings about it. People who are against gay marriage tend to be, you know, I'm going to betray my politics in this, but they're homophobes. And they get nervous when they see, you know, things like blog posts saying how successful No on 8 is being. So if you were to send, you know, so it makes sense if their goal was to excite their base, make sure their base showed up to vote, to send them to something that had No on 8 bragging that they were going to win or that they were very close, because it would help motivate the people who clicked through to go out and vote against it.
Okay. But Tom, you are putting your finger on a very interesting question sort of on the frontier of this type of use of technology, and it's definitely one. We will make sure to get somebody from Google to answer this question. Possibly we'll have a whole call with them. Okay, other questions from folks? Neil Rechtman, by the way, is a very simple question. What is the Google product that is being used for contextual ads? Is that AdSense?
It's AdWords. Well,
AdWords.
So AdSense is the Google product that if you had a website that you wanted to make money off of, you would use to put the ads on your site. AdWords is the way you buy the ads in the AdSense network.
Okay. Other questions from people on the call? Just unmute your phone if you're trying to ask a question. I have a, there's a question in the chat. What behavior, this is from Justin Safey, what behavioral targeting ad networks do you use and or recommend?
Well, that's a tough question because the behavioral networks, behavioral targeting is one of those things that's so cutting edge, month to month, it changes. I will say that I have found Specific Media, which is, I believe, a top 10 ad network in terms of its sheer reach, has been particularly helpful and seems to have a, seems to have wrapped their heads around the type of targeting that political campaigns want to do, and so they're already doing a lot of the profiling we want.
Okay, Specific Media is the name of the company?
Mm-hmm.
Where are they based?
I have no idea.
Okay, hopefully Google does know. Okay, I have a question, which is, we're describing a real frontier here. To what degree do you think a campaign also has to, in effect, play defense as well as offense and be tracking how its opponent, adversary, whether it's, you know, the person you're running against or whatever issue group, what kind of online advertising they're doing? I mean, you know, coming off the Franken campaign or other campaigns, I mean, have you seen campaigns kind of get into ad wars with each other where they're trying to outbid for clicks? Or, you know, what sort of strategies would you suggest in that environment?
Well, you absolutely need to be playing defense. If somebody is buying a key, if your opponent is buying a keyword for whatever reason, you also want to have that keyword. If just because, you know,
so how do you discover what keywords they're buying? I mean, then now we're talking about having to play even more defense.
There are softwares out there specifically for spying on each other's campaigns.
You want to mention any of them, or is this a trade secret?
Well, the reason I don't want to mention any of them is because they're all pretty bad, and so I don't want to suggest anything and then have someone be like, well, I didn't notice this one. But if you just Google ad tracking, online ad tracking software, you'll get a half dozen of them, and they're all pretty mediocre.
So what? How do you know they're mediocre?
Just because I've used them, and I've spied on my own campaigns because I know exactly what's in the campaigns,
mm-hmm.
and seen that they don't hit everything, they don't pick up everything.
So you might use these, but you wouldn't completely rely on them.
Right.
How many?
A lot of it. Go
right.
Ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, a lot of it is the way that those softwares work is you type in the address, the web address that the ads point to, and it detects what campaigns are pointing to that address. But the problem is if someone is pointing to an address you're not expecting, like it's easy to track the campaigns that are pointing at their website or at your website or at microsites they've created. But if they're pointing ads at random little things like articles or YouTube videos, unless someone sees that ad and clicks through and captures that URL, it's very difficult to figure, you know, there's no way to go out there and just say, mine the internet for the ads my opponent is running. So you have to identify the landing pages to track.
Okay, I want to ask you a bit more about the nuts and bolts of doing this for a campaign.
Sure.
In the piece that you did in Politics Magazine, you wrote that you nano-targeted, this is on the Franken campaign, more than 125 niche groups with more than 1,000 pieces of creative for less than $100,000 on Google alone, an acquisition budget of less than $20,000 got us more than 20,000 clicks, 5,500 active email signups, and more than 2,500 donors. We were able to reach persuasion niches, that is akin to someone opening up and reading a mail piece, for a fraction of a penny per impression and less than 50 cents per interaction. Now, I'm curious, how many keywords were you buying advertising around, and how much monitoring work it took to do all of this both, you know, testing and tracking how your different words were doing, how your different pieces of creative were doing. I mean, it sounds to me like this is a job for, you know, a half dozen people.
It's certainly something that you want to outsource, at least at the end of the campaign when you have a ton of creative running. In the very beginning of the campaign, most of what you're running is acquisition-oriented, and acquisition, at the end of the day, it's just harder to get people to sign up or to donate, and so there just aren't that many, there's not that much ad inventory out there that's going to be effective at that. So early on, it's very easy to do acquisition in-house, but when you get to persuasion, where you have just literally thousands of pieces of creative running to tens of thousands of keywords, and this cycle I anticipate doing hundreds of thousands of keywords, you really want to outsource that.
Okay, but you just said something, hundreds of thousands of keywords. Now, is someone manually inputting each keyword for each campaign? I mean, that's a...
Well, so for instance, when you put in, when you're making these ads, say we're making ads around the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
You can type in the Iraq War as a keyword, and Google has a keyword tool that will suggest other keywords back at you.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone has to actually go through and click approve on all the suggested keywords.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to sync them up. And so it will spit back at you, you know, 10 for every one you put in generally. So coming up with 1,000 keywords takes about 25 minutes, maybe a half
okay.
hour.
Okay.
So it's not that much of an arduous process. What is an arduous process is going through the returns on keywords, like sorting them and filtering them, and saying, okay, of our Iraq War keywords, people who are noticing the keywords like Fallujah, Baghdad, the Green Zone, ones that are very specific keywords to geographic places in Iraq, tend to outperform ones that use the word Iraq itself. And you have to try to tease out why that is. In that case, we thought it was because typically when things like Fallujah are used, it's to talk about an event that happened in Iraq, like a roadside bombing. And so the people who are reading about it are probably more likely to be frustrated with it. People who are just reading something that contains the word Iraq could be reading, Red State talking about how we need to support our troops in Iraq, and you could be targeting the exact opposite audience you're going for.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But thinking about advertising around keywords around Iraq is a way to find, in this case, I presume, anti-war democratic activists who might have been inclined to support an anti-war Senate candidate.
Indeed. Though Iraq keywords are words you would use primarily for persuasion on Iraq messaging, not necessarily for acquisition.
Why is that?
Just because they weren't converting very well.
Ah, so you tested them and you saw this is not a very strong way to convert, to find yourself young volunteers, let's say.
Yes.
How much do you watch things like Google Trends to see, you know, what new terms are rising high in Google search on a daily basis? Do you do any of that?
Yes. Towards the second half of the campaign, it's a daily thing. Towards the persuasion.
What are you looking
period,
for? Yeah, yeah.
Well, in the last couple weeks of the campaign, which is when Google Trends is the most relevant,
mm-hmm.
for everyone who doesn't know what Google Trends is on this call, it's a tool that allows you to compare the popularity of search terms to each other.
Well, you can also get a list of the most popular terms. I mean, I subscribe to an RSS feed, so, you know, every hour I can see what the top 100 search phrases are on Google.
Right. And so, for instance, what the McCain campaign did this last cycle, and this is actually very clever, is in the last couple days of the election, when they just wanted to saturate everything, they were buying the top 100 keywords, even if they had nothing to do with them.
The top 100 search terms.
Yeah,
in effect.
Even if they had nothing to do with John McCain, even if they were eBay, just because 3 days before an election, you know, you want to saturate everything. And if you pick the top 100 terms, you're going to get the, you know, the biggest chunk of the search audience,
mm-hmm.
even if it's not particularly well-targeted at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But again, they're not worrying about click-throughs. They're just worrying about impressions.
Yep.
Right? So in many cases, all they were doing was naming a high bid, hoping people aren't clicking through.
Yeah, they were basically doing the equivalent of putting yard signs on street corners.
But without having to pay for them.
Well, no, at that point they were paying. Well, because to buy a keyword like eBay,
mm-hmm.
I would imagine the cost per click is $10 or more.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if they weren't paying for their impressions, they were paying so much for their clicks that they might as well have been paying for their impressions.
I see. So I'm assuming that if you buy the word eBay and your ad says, support John McCain for president, someone who's reading about eBay isn't going to click. But
that's true. But in order, because people aren't clicking, so the way the ad networks sell their ad space is through an instantaneous auction. And what it does is it compares all of the people who are eligible to have their ads appear to determine which ones are going to be of the highest value to Google. And so the math is not just how much you're bidding, but the expected value of your ad impression. So if your ad is twice as likely to get clicked as my ad, you tend to only have to bid half as much to outbid me.
Right. So if your ad starts doing well, you can lower your bid. Or does Google do that for you automatically?
No, you have to do it. But with the eBay example we were just discussing, since the likelihood of a click was very, very low, they had to jack up the cost per click in order to win the auction.
Understood.
And so, so yes, the impressions were gravy, but in order to even get those impressions for those keywords with such low quality scores and such irrelevant ads, they had to pay through the teeth for every click.
Right. And take the chance that their opponent might say...
click on it over and over and over again, yes.
To cost them.
Uh-huh.
Okay, other questions? I mean, I've got more, but I want to make room for the folks who are listening. We're now at 45 minutes into the call, so we have only 15 more minutes. If you have a question for Josh Koster, just unmute your phone or post it into the chat, and I'll pass it along. Okay, I'm going to ask another question. Josh, we've mostly been talking about how you do this when you're thinking about the dynamics of an election campaign, which has a beginning, middle, and end, right? And so at the beginning, you know, and you talked about how at the beginning you might focus more on acquisition and later you might focus more on persuasion, and towards the end you might really be focusing on just blanketing, you know, the entire space to the, mm-hmm. To the best of your ability. But how do these dynamics change if we're not working on an election campaign, but we're working on some kind of issue campaign that may be more open-ended? You know, let's say the client is a environmental organization or a trade group, the National Cable and Telecom, they've got ongoing issues. They may partly be looking to sign up members, but more likely trying to advance a piece of legislation or an approach to a bill. Do you think this kind of targeting makes sense in that environment, and how would you use it differently?
Well, it absolutely makes sense. You still have to distinguish between if your goal is acquisition or persuasion. Some issue groups are going to have a very hard time with acquisition, particularly if they have big helicopter going overhead. Particularly if they have an issue that isn't very sexy. But issue campaigns that have issues that have diehard followers like environmentalism or civil rights, they're going to have to be very successful with acquisition. In fact, they're probably going to acquire for less than the cost of a campaign, mostly because they can target nationwide.
But as I listen to you, I'm thinking one of the beautiful things about this approach is that it does allow you, if you are creative enough, to reach deep into the long tail. I mean, if there's a way to reach people who are, taking care of their elderly parent at home and interested in somebody giving them a tax break to help them afford that, that's never going to be a national sexy issue. And yet, what you've described for us is a way to, you know, micro-target those people as they do what they do online and, you know, get in front of them.
Right?
So it doesn't have to be a sexy issue, does it?
No, it doesn't, but it does for acquisition. People simply, it doesn't have to be a sexy issue to everybody, but it has to be sexy in as much as the people who care about it have to care immensely about it. That's why gay rights works so well. For instance, that's why the NRA has had such phenomenal success with direct mail.
Right.
Is because people who they send it to really care about that issue.
This seems to be true of any kind of political organizing. I mean,
sure. But to answer your question, it is useful for persuasion around those issues because asking somebody to look at something that might sway their opinion on something is a much smaller ask than asking somebody to give their information to you so that you can email them action alerts. And so if you're trying to advocate a certain piece of legislation, you can absolutely nano-target down and build awareness for your issue. And it's always great for that, sexy or not sexy. But if you're trying to do acquisition around an issue, the sexiness of the issue and the awareness around that issue will have a large impact on your success with acquisition. Chances are you'll always be able to acquire some people very cheaply, but if there's a very small audience of people out there who know, who care about your issue at all, there's only going to be a very small amount of inventory out there to reach those people, which means you're only going to get a couple acquisitions.
I've got two questions in the chat that actually both are interrelated, so I'm going to read both of them to you. The first one is from Henri McKembe, and it says, what percentage of the ad budget should local and state candidates devote to online ads? And then from Justin Safey, what prices should a typical campaign expect to pay per click, or what is a reasonable cost of acquisition for a single donor or a single email address?
Okay, to address the first question, the percentage you spend on online advertising does need to be in some way influenced by your constituency. If you're running in a rural district that doesn't have broadband penetration yet, then by and large you don't need to spend that much of your budget on it. But if you're running statewide really anywhere or in a district with an urban center, you're going to want a much larger chunk of your budget. I think the sort of the midpoint as a percent of your media budget should be 5 to 7.5% of it. And if you're in an urban center, it should be higher. If you're in an area that doesn't have high internet adoption, it should be lower.
And I'm just going to follow up on that before we get to Justin's question. And from what you've been talking about, it sounds to me like you are much more taken with the efficiency and power of nano-targeting using things like the Google Ad Network or Facebook than you would be, say, with buying a slate of blog ads on a group of political blogs?
Political blogs are sort of tightly targeted audiences in and of themselves. And so if that's your audience to reach, going and buying a slate of blog ads, or I prefer going and buying ads from Common Sense Media, they reach the same audience, but I found better results with them.
I was referring to blog ads in the generic sense. I mean, obviously it's the name of the company.
If your audience is liberal blog readers or conservative blog readers for a certain message, then just go out and buy it through one of the verticals. I'm much more taken with the idea of using long-tail nano-targeting than, for instance, buying ads on newspaper websites. And the reason for that is some of the people reading that website are just there for a high school sports score. They're, you know, they may or may not be voters. Most of the smaller newspapers don't have sophisticated ad serving platforms. So, for instance, they can't geo-target. So if, for instance, which this happened in Florida recently, if an NFL player drowns off the coast of a small town and the first article about it is from a newspaper no one's ever heard of, then that newspaper is going to get flooded with out-of-state traffic. And if you've bought non-geo-targeted ads on it, you're going to pay for a ton of impressions to people who can't vote.
Right.
So it really just comes down to using the network that is best for your audience. So long-tail nano-target, it's really best to be on 5, 6, 7, 8 networks at once, because certain networks are good at reaching certain audiences. And then to address Justin Safety's question, evaluating the cost per acquisition or the value of a cost per acquisition is a sliding scale. An acquisition very early in a campaign is worth considerably more money than an acquisition later in a campaign. And the reason being that you have, you know, if you get somebody 2 years out, you have 2 years to solicit them for money. If you get somebody 1 year out, you have half as long to solicit them. So that acquisition is half as valuable to you.
Mm-hmm.
With donor acquisitions, the value of the acquisition is equal to the value of the average donation. And the reason for that is once they've donated, they'll probably give again. So even if you break even on the amount of money that comes in from the donation ads, you're still coming out ahead because some of those people will give again on a resolicit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions from people? I thought I heard somebody maybe getting unmuting their phone. Okay, we're down to about 5 minutes. I'm wondering if there's anything, Josh, about privacy in this situation that is of concern to you. I mean, is there, you know, this is such a new arena, and people are definitely sensitive, right, to having advertising targeted to them that, you know, seems to intrude on their privacy in some way. And is that a concern for you, and does that come up as a concern for campaigns as well? I mean, how do we walk that line?
Well, behavioral targeting in particular is a little controversial, and some people will get annoyed if you do it. Especially if someone writes a piece, like a blog post, about how you're doing behavioral targeting.
Mm-hmm.
All the other ones, you know, people have learned that Google Ads are smart, and so they don't get upset that you're running Google Ads. Same with Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So no, in general, it's not a concern. You do have to be a little careful with behavioral, particularly if you're going negative. But there is one very big concern about upsetting people with these ads, and that is when you're running literally thousands of pieces of creative, there is a much higher likelihood that one of those pieces of creative will be offensive to somebody, and so, for instance, if a congressional race was going to run 5 TV spots over the course of a cycle, that means they only have to have 5 ads that don't offend people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're running 1,000, you mean you have to have 1,000 ads that don't offend people, and so you have to be extra careful not to run ads that somebody is going to take a screenshot of and then write an op-ed about.
Right, but just to go back to your example about the people with elderly parents, right? So while it's true that, you know, say advertising on sites that have something to do with, you know, home alert systems, and somebody sees an Al Franken ad that says he's got a great position on tax breaks for people taking care of their elderly parents, they click through and they land on I presume, you know, you were trying to acquire their email address, right? But what if you then turn around and email that person in a way that makes pretty clear that you know they have an elderly parent at home, right? I've not really volunteered that information to you, but you know it, or you're pretty sure, based on the fact that I clicked through that very finely targeted piece of advertising. Isn't there a privacy issue that can arise there?
There would be, but frankly, when you're talking about niches that small,
mm-hmm.
and to be clear, that was a persuasion niche, not an acquisition niche. And
okay.
So we didn't get very many. Like, we weren't trying to get email addresses. We weren't landing them on pages meant to convert for email addresses. We were landing them on persuasive pages.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of people that we would have been able to collect that way and message to that way is infinitesimal, and we wouldn't be sending those emails.
You wouldn't bother sending a micro-targeted email saying, because you have an elderly parent at home, this is why you should support Al.
Right, because the more specific the niche gets, the smaller the niche gets,
yeah.
And it gets small fast. And so while if you're running ads that are acquisition-oriented saying, sign this petition to demand that the banks, you know, be more transparent with their bailout funds, people who sign that petition are not going to get pissed. Or well, they might be, but it's okay to message them on the AIG thing because they entered their email address into something about AIG.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wouldn't take them by that much surprise to get an email, I don't think.
No, right. Well, there are different kinds of privacy. I mean, I've told you I'm interested in an issue, okay, but knowing that I'm gay or knowing that I've got a, you know, sick parent or something, they cut in different ways.
Right. And so I guess what I'm saying is the ones that are big enough to then do follow-up emails with narrowcast messaging in them,
mm-hmm.
the niches that are big enough to do those follow-up emails, tend to also be wide enough that privacy becomes less of a concern.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they end up being more like the AIG scenario than like the elder care scenario.
Right. Right. Very interesting. Well, listen, we're coming to the end of the call. Is there any last words you want to end with, Josh? How do people find you?
JohnDesigns.com. We only work with progressives or issue groups that don't have a strongly conservative bent. It can be in the middle or the left. I'd love to hear from any of y'all, even if you have small budgets.
Okay.
I think
we can
show you the numbers to raise your budgets later.
Josh is going to be speaking at PDF at the conference this year in June. I should mention that we're going to have Eric Frenchman on, who did very similar work to Josh for the McCain campaign, as well as other Republican campaigns. It'll be very interesting to compare and contrast approaches, and they'll be doing a panel together at PDF along with Kate Kay, who writes about online advertising for ClickZ. So that brings us to the end of our hour. Thank you again, Josh Koster, for joining us on this PDF Network conference call on long-tail nanotargeting. Thanks again to AT&T and the Bivings Group, our sponsors for the PDF Network, for their ongoing support. Again, we'll see everybody in 2 weeks for a call with Ben Smith and Anna Marie Cox on how to pitch political bloggers and how not to pitch them. Please share news of the PDF Network with your friends, and look forward to seeing you all again in 2 weeks.